This is Positive Parenting. Parenting expertise and advice from best-selling parenting author and national newspaper columnist, Mr. Dad, Armin Brott.
Hey there, welcome to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott. There is a crisis that millions of families face each fall. How to get their child into highly selective colleges. In 2014, the Ivy League received almost 250,000 applications for 14,000 spots, while one of the top public universities, UCLA, received over 85,000 applications for 5,800 spots in its freshman class. This crisis spirals out of control as the number of applicants from the U.S. and abroad skyrockets. As a result of this, parents nationwide are terrified. Valedictorians, applicants with perfect SAT scores, and student body presidents are not getting into their top college choices. While families collectively panic about how to get their high-achieving children into selective universities, other applicants who attend the most expensive prep schools or spend $25,000 for college admission counseling regularly earn admissions to the most selective colleges. What's their secret? Well, the answer is simple. These applicants, with significant guidance, produce tailor-made college applications that emphasize passions, skills, and interests that college admissions officers covet. In this part of today's show, we're going to be giving you the same advice that will help to get your child into a highly selective college. It all starts right after this.
My name is Ruth Roosey, and this is how I live United. I read to children as part of United Way's education program. It helps them create links between language and literacy and prepares them for a better academic future. I figure I have the time and they have the need. My name is Ruth Roosey. I help kids prepare to succeed in school. So I don't just wear the shirt, I live it.
Give, advocate, volunteer, live United. Go to liveunited.org. Brought to you by United Way and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott. My guest for this part of today's show is Greg Kaplan, who is the author of Earning Admission, Real Strategies for Getting into Highly Selective Colleges. Greg, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on the show today, Armin.
Let's talk about highly selective colleges, because that's something I think that comes up with a lot of these discussions, and there's several different schools of thought. One of them says that highly selective colleges are really not the best place for most people to go. But they have big names, and so everybody kind of wants to apply anyway. Do you think that highly selective colleges should be everybody's goal?
No, I don't necessarily think that. When I refer to highly selective, I'm also including our own UC system, where schools where it's very competitive and very hard to get into, just based on the sheer number of applicants. I think there are schools or colleges where students might be a great fit that are not selective, but even for California's and a lot of state institutions nationwide, the number of applicants applying have made them very selective. So do I think when some people think of very selective, do they think of Harvard and Yale? Yes, that's true, and that is not the best fit for everyone. But even for schools that make sense financially for a family or someone who want to attend in state, this term also applies.
Right, right. No, I just wanted to make sure that we got that out of the way a little bit, because I think, yeah, you know, whenever the topic comes up or I talk about it or we have a guest on the show who's talking about it, people say, come on, I mean, you know, everybody wants to apply to Harvard because it sounds good, but it's just not the right place for, you know, for people in many different majors. I mean, they've got really great programs in certain things, but, you know, other people, artists, for example, probably would be better served going someplace else. Anyway, that's didn't want to spend too much time on it. Just wanted to have you address that really quickly. When does the whole college process start, college application process start?
I recommend that people start being thoughtful, families start being thoughtful about the college application process in ninth grade. When the time comes to actually apply for college to colleges, applicants already have 3 years of grades. They have their extracurricular activities set, and they've really developed into people that will be adding value to a college campus. I like to work with people in ninth grade to start laying the creating a plan for that. And I think in ninth grade it's very easy to map out what how to achieve the goal of getting into a college that is a great fit for a student.
You know, I took my daughter to Bard College years ago, and she went there the whole way through and dropped her off. And there was a meeting with a bunch of the parents and the head of the school, a guy named Botstein, Leon Botstein. Very interesting guy. And one of the parents, I remember in this meeting, stood up and said, I'm so concerned about my son because he's got into Bard and he got into a number of other places, but he's going here, and we have no clue what he wants to major in, and we're just really worried that he's going to be floundering. And Dr. Botstein says, you know, I really like it when kids come into college without a major because, and I remember this line has always stuck with me, because so many kids who come into college with a major are majoring in something that other people have told them that they're good at, and it's not necessarily something that they want to do. And I'm kind of wondering about your recommendation about ninth grade, about whether that gets, you know, kind of eliminates the possibilities for some kids. If they're focusing on getting into college, are they going to be focusing on something in particular to study, or just the idea of just getting into a college to do something productive?
Sure. I think the conversation early in high school should involve helping a child dedicate herself to her passions, her skills, and her interests that will in turn make her a valuable applicant in the process 4 years later. Nothing should be done just for the sake of applying to college. But people ask, well, how do I get Susie or Johnny into Harvard? Harvard looks for very talented applicants in something that they are passionate about. And what I love to see in high school students is that if they're truly interested in ballet or robotics, that they dedicate themselves to that. And that is something that's going to permeate throughout the entire college application, the passion in that. They can discuss that in the personal statement. They can find ways to excel in those areas that in turn a college admissions officer will value. So really the conversation in ninth grade should revolve around what does my child love to do, and how can I help them become better in what they love to do? Because we want our kids to be passionate adults. We want them to excel in what they enjoy, and we want to give them the opportunities to do so.
You know, you've mentioned a couple of times adding value from the perspective of the university. Explain that a little bit. What are they looking for? Because they have an agenda, just like parents and children have an agenda. We want to get our kids into some place, and so that they'll get a good education. But rarely talk about what it is that the colleges want. It's not just a completely selfless thing about giving kids education. They're trying to provide a certain type of it. But so talk about the value part.
Sure. College admissions officers every year look for athletes for their sports teams. That's why students are recruited to play sports. They look for people who will be performing in their orchestra or in their school-sponsored performing arts groups. They look for students who can conduct research in their labs, participate in studies, and they look for the next generation of campus leaders. So we talk a lot about leadership and how that is, that's a buzzword in the college admissions process. And why do they want leaders? They want leaders to lead the student organizations or work with the school to propel the school forward. So they look for every student that they select fills a role. And I mean, from a base level, there's also the importance that they will be able to thrive academically. But above that, for a school that admits less applicants than the number who apply, there is a push to find students who can fulfill the roles that they need. So the more value, if there's a niche sport, say squash or crew, where it is harder to find, there are less high school rowers than, say, high school soccer players, a applicant who demonstrates that they can row crew in college adds value to that school. And the same would go for maybe a unique instrument within the university's orchestra. That's value added to it on top of an ability to perform academically and contribute to the learning of the entire school.
Are colleges, generally speaking, all looking for the same things, just in varying degrees, or are there different levels of what they're looking for?
I would say that colleges are looking, you know, in general, they're looking for students who can benefit from the education and also add to other students' education. But for some of these colleges that are extremely challenging to get into, they're looking for a student who can add to a specific program and that that there's a need for. Because every year they do need to, if there is a symphony or a sports competition, they do need students in these. And I also think they're looking for perspective. A college education is a tremendous gift. It's a tremendous investment by a family. And they're looking for people who can really add to that conversation. So this brings us to the topic of a personal statement and why it's so important to demonstrate perspective, maturity, candor, because those are traits that in a classroom discussion, whether it's just a few students or if it's in a study group from a large lecture, that students will be relying on their own experiences to contribute to not just their learning but others.
Now, I remember helping the friends or the children of a number of friends of mine with their college applications and their essays, and I'm a writer professionally, and have found that the things that are kind of counterintuitive for them as far as the essay process go, writing about failings or writing about things that haven't been perfect in their life, are the ones that seem to be the most impactful rather than trying to write something that makes them sound like perfection.
I absolutely agree with you in that assessment. My take on the personal statement is that this should be an extraordinary perspective on something that is rather ordinary, because if it's just rehashing how perfect someone is or their achievements, that should already be somewhere else in the application if they've won the Nobel Prize or the runner-up to succeed Mother Teresa. That the ability to demonstrate someone's extracurricular activities, there is a spot for that. But what they don't know is what kind of person this is. Is this someone that is going to add to the culture? And there's been a lot of buzz recently about a student who did tremendously well in the college admissions process. She wrote about how Costco, a shopping trip to Costco, was a representation of her just, you know, innate curiosity, and why she, when she's sampling different foods at Costco, it represents how she's going to approach her college education when it comes to taking classes and not knowing which type of major she wants to come in.
That's interesting.
And she was extremely successful in the college admissions process. This applicant is going to Stanford next year and was admitted to Yale, Penn, I mean, all of the big names. And this is something about, I do happen to like Costco a lot, but this is a, this is an essay that just really resonated about, wow, this person can take the most simple thing in life, grocery shopping, and connect it to her education, and it just demonstrates perspective. I wrote about my parents' separation, having grow up very quickly, and that someone said was, oh, that's so cliche, but the perspective is what matters.
Right. Talking with Greg Kaplan, who's the author of Earning Admission, Real Strategies for Getting into Highly Selective Schools. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll keep talking about these real strategies.
There once was a boy wizard whose name was Larry Smarter.
Larry, why weren't you in Professor Dinky Doodle's mythical creature classification class?
Well, I'm taking Algebra 2 in a foreign language.
Oh, so you can talk to unicorns?
Exactly. Unless they're French.
Larry wanted to go to college, so he visited knowhowtogo.org to find the classes he really needed. Getting into college doesn't happen magically. Learn more at knowhowtogo.org.
Brought to you by the American Council on Education, Lumina Foundation for Education, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott. If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Greg Kaplan, who's the author of Earning Admission, Real Strategies for Getting into Highly Selective Schools. In part one of the book, you talk about two things, the high school transcript and the entrance exam scores. And that just brought, as I was just even looking at those titles on the table of contents, brought back another memory of my older daughter, who is out of college already, but she was so frustrated by those two things. She was a complete straight-A student. I think her GPA was 4.3 or something like that, because she had so many AP classes and A-pluses, and things, you know, so she got all these extra credit for that. But she was a terrible test taker, and she was frequently complaining, and I think she was absolutely right. She, you know, 4 years' worth of straight A's seemed to be given the same weight as 4 hours worth of a test. And what are colleges doing about that? I mean, I know that my daughter's not the only one who sees a certain amount of unfairness there, that because of anxiety or because of whatever, just some people just don't test well.
I completely sympathize with your daughter on this. That's a feeling I felt taking the SAT years ago, and I get it. Let's step back, though, from the perspective of an admissions officer who might not be able to compare the high school that an applicant attends to another high school across the country. The SAT is a baseline to compare the level of how prepared an applicant is for college. And I don't think this is the most accurate way to do it. I think there are better measures. I think a 4.3 GPA, to me, demonstrates a lot of work ethic, which is probably what is the greatest indicator of success. But there is a push to have less emphasis on SAT scores or ACT scores and high school GPA and a more holistic approach to this. But these are recommendations. This came out of the Harvard Graduate School of Education to adopt a more holistic approach. I think this is something we should aspire for, but we should still be prepared that at the end of the day, the two most important factors in the college application process are the entrance exam and the GPA. And so we can aspire for this, but to not prepare.
It's going to be there.
Yeah, it's got to be there. And then what I like to think is everything else in the subjective part of the applications, how you can really wow an admissions officer and say, well, maybe their SAT score is just a tad bit low, but maybe an amazing essay will get you over the hump. But at the end of the day, you have to have those. Depending on the type of school someone's aspiring for, it's a necessary evil right now.
Yeah. You know, you talk about having an application theme. What do you mean by that?
Sure. Earning admission, and when I work with clients, it's all about creating a brand for someone. And this is something that a student will have to do when they apply for a job or to grad school. It's to put everything together, is that this is a person who is passionate about psychology and wants to go into mental health. And in high school, this applicant's community service revolved around a service organization that provided, even if she wasn't providing the counseling, revolved around providing counseling to returning vets, and took AP psychology in high school if it was offered, and maybe took even a more advanced class in community college over summer because that's what she loved to do, and maybe worked, and there's some tie to maybe it was babysitting, even if it was babysitting, just tying the babysitting to understanding the needs of a child and being able to reflect that in the personal statement. It's creating that cohesive theme, like, I get this applicant. They're not just doing activities for the sake of doing activities. Admissions officers know when they just, I'm going to check that box because that's what I think I need to do. They're looking for people who are truly passionate, and the theme and tying all the different components of the application together demonstrates passion. It demonstrates skill, and that's what demonstrates that added value to a college.
Let's talk a little bit about extracurricular activities, because I know that those have, at least the theory about them has changed somewhat. I mean, people are getting shoved into a ton of different extracurricular activities, and then there's also the idea that everybody has to go to a third world country and build houses for poor people or something like that. That was very popular for a while. I think that's, people have backed off a little bit about that. But what should the strategy be, and you're talking again about starting in ninth grade, for building up a good portfolio of extracurriculars that are going to actually get somebody to take note?
Sure. The first and most important thing is the extracurricular activity should be aligned with someone's interests. If your child is passionate about, if your child's passionate about, let's say, becoming a psychologist, I'll use this example again, find extracurricular activities that demonstrate that interest. Volunteering or counseling center, things along those natures. The community service should tie to that. Above and beyond with anything, there needs to be a student needs to be able to demonstrate her leadership abilities. So it's one thing to be in a club, but it's another thing to lead it. And colleges are looking for the next generation of student leaders. If there is an organization, the student should aspire to be a leader. And if there's not an organization, demonstrate entrepreneurship and start one yourself. there's no magic recipe for having a million different activities. That just leads to burnout, and I think that leads to students becoming a little jaded that, hey, I did everything. I did everything I didn't even want to do, and that, you know, it shows. So it doesn't need to, it's not the quantity of the activities, it's the quality. And quality talks about leadership, the depth, the achievement within that activity. When we talk about the arts, people ask, well, how do I demonstrate my child is a great writer or is an expert debater? There are plenty of opportunities to showcase an applicant's talent. So whatever the activity is, sports, we can put that into context fairly easily because there are tournaments, there are ways to become ranked depending on the sport. But when it comes to the arts, an applicant could submit, if they're very passionate about writing, they can submit editorials to local newspapers, they can enter writing competitions. It's about earning recognition in those activities to demonstrate a high skill level. So I think leadership and then demonstrated excellence can go a long way. And the activity can be ordinary. It just it matters what the applicant did with it. There's no need to go to Botswana to build a village. If there's something at home that makes sense for that person, that they can demonstrate that, wow, I spent 300 hours over 4 years providing counsel or assisting with a counseling mission, or I led this organization that raised, you know, $5,000, $10,000, $20,000 from the community. I think those things stand out, especially if you can tie it to a personal statement and demonstrate the importance of it.
So where's the line, I guess, between passion and giving the colleges what they want to see? Because those are not 100% mutually exclusive, but they're not 100% the same either.
Correct. Certain activities do go further. When we talk about sports, I like to use example. There are over 360,000 high school female soccer players, and there are 30,000-odd spots across every NCAA affiliated college for soccer. So there are, when an admissions officer sees a varsity soccer player, well, there are a lot of those. So yep. Unless they're truly gifted, less value. But when we talk about crew, there are 7,200 spots for women rowers in college. And by estimates of the National Rowing Association, 3,600 female rowers in high school.
Wow.
So if I'm an admissions officer and I see, wow, this person has been doing crew for 4 years and isn't already talking to the crew coach, that's value. Because I need to find, there are more spots in that boat than students who can row applying. So that isn't the demonstration value. I think niche activities really set people apart, because at the end of the day, a college does need to fill its orchestra. And you hear stories where students who play the clarinet somehow, you know, all things equal, the clarinet player gets in over a more common instrument player. So it's finding that niche. And finding a niche is a great life skill in general. It's why doctors specialize, attorneys specialize. The business that handles a certain type of problem or addresses a certain type of customer builds loyalty because they're the only game in town. I think we want to encourage our children to find their passion. Let that passion be a niche.
And where do they find this information about if they're looking for odd instruments or sports to pursue? You just rattled off some statistics. Where did that come from?
Sure. The college athlete, there's a website that accumulates all the NCAA statistics. The name slips from my mind, but it's for every sport. I did tweet about this when I said got crew. If not, you should. Armin, that'd be something I'd be more than happy to share with you.
Yeah.
I can follow up.
But, that'd be great. I'll put it up on, put a link on the website. That'd be great.
Yeah.
Okay. Greg Kaplan.
Greg
Kaplan's the author of Earning Admission, Real Strategies for Getting into Highly Selective Colleges. And you mentioned something about tweeting. Where else can people make contact with you?
Sure. My webpage is www.earningadmission.com, the name of the book. And I have a advice blog, and I do online question and answer forum. And should people want to follow me on Twitter, I'm happy to engage in any actually form of communication with that.
All right, Greg, thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me, Armin.
Hi, this is John Ondrasik of Five for Fighting, here for RAD, the entertainment industry's voice for road safety. You know, style is a personal thing, and your lifestyle is your business. But if you take it on the road, it becomes everybody's business. So please, plan ahead, designate before you celebrate. Friends, don't let friends drive drunk.
A public service announcement brought to you by RAD, the National Association of Broadcasters, and the Ad Council.
Hey there, welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott, and it's time for an Ask Mr. Dad segment. And today's question is one that I get quite often from divorced parents, and especially during the summer. Dear Mr. Dad, I'm a divorced mom, and because of my past substance abuse issues, my ex-husband has primary physical custody of our children. I only get to see them on weekends, and we miss each other terribly. I've been trying to make it up to them by filling every weekend with outings and activities, but I think I've made a mistake. More than anything, I want to just hang out with the kids, but every time I schedule some downtime, they complain that they're bored. What can I do? I am so glad that you wrote. I get this question a lot from non-custodial dads, but it's important for readers to understand that when the roles are reversed, moms often experience the same problems. A lot of non-custodial parents, especially those with limited time with their children, fall into the same trap you did. Sometimes, like you, it's because they feel guilty about not having been around as much as they'd like to. Sometimes they're trying to earn their children's love, and sometimes they're trying to compete with their former spouse. The result is a non-stop party, filled with expensive gifts and trips, little or no discipline or responsibilities, then that means no homework or chores, and treating the kids like royalty instead of children. Hence the nickname, Disneyland Parents. As you've discovered, this model simply isn't sustainable. Eventually, you'll run out of money or ideas, and even if you don't, you'll end up with no relationship with your children. Plus, they'll be so spoiled that if you pull the plug on the fun, they'll think you don't love them anymore, or they'll resent you for taking away what they feel they deserve. Here's how you can turn back the clock. Pretend the kids live with you full time. That means making sure their homework is finished, chores are assigned and done, and that they do their piano practice. Also, try to schedule some one-on-one time with each child and some unstructured screen-free downtime, even if they claim they're bored. Have a reasonable amount of fun. You can't possibly entertain them every minute, so don't even try. Of course, some of your weekends are going to be packed to the gills with great activities, but don't make them all that way. Be normal. Accept that you may need to spend a few hours on a project from the office or doing some household repairs. Having the kids help out is a wonderful way to spend time together and makes them feel that they're a part of your life. It also reminds them that you're human and have obligations and responsibilities. Get their input. Ask them to put together a list of activities they'd like to do. You won't get to them all, but the fact that you've asked them lets them know that you genuinely care about what's important to them. Be normal. Some days you'll have tons of energy to run around all day. Other times you'll feel like a slug, just like everyone else in the world. Your kids will understand. You and they will occasionally have fights, too. Don't worry. The kids won't stop loving you. Fights are perfectly normal in intact families and just as normal in broken ones. As a non-custodial mom, your goal is to have as normal a relationship with your children as possible. There's no need to compete with your ex, and you don't need to buy their love. If you genuinely love your children and are interested in being with them, they'll know it. And they'll love you and want to be with you, too. You can find a lot more Ask Mr. Dad columns at our website, MrDad.com/ask. We'll be back next week with another Ask Mr. Dad segment or a Parents at Play segment, depending on which week it is. Hey, but don't go quite yet, because there's a lot more positive parenting coming up right now.
More with Mr. Dad, Armin Brott, after this, from the MrDad.com radio network.
McGruff the Crime Dog here. Let's hear from an identity thief.
Identities are easy to catch online. I send people an official-looking email pretending to be their bank or credit card company and ask them to confirm their personal information. Books them every time.
Safeguard your personal information on the phone, online, and especially at home, because half of identity theft occurs by someone you think you know. Keep your identity to yourself and take a bite out of crime. Learn more from the National Crime Prevention Council at ncpc.org.
A message from this station, the U.S. Department of Justice, Crime Prevention Coalition of America, and the National Crime Prevention Council.
Now, get ready for more positive parenting with Armin Brott from the MrDad.com radio network.
Hey there, thanks for sticking with us. This is the second part of today's Positive Parenting Show. Americans disagree about a lot of things, and it's always going to be that way. But we're betting that most of you would share concerns about these five questions. Are you confident that Social Security and Medicare will be solvent enough to meet the promises when you and your children need them? Do you want to live in a society in which a tiny fraction of the public and a few corporations hold a greater share of the wealth than has ever been in America before? Must your health care cost almost twice as much as it costs your counterparts in every other advanced nation? Why can't the schools of this affluent and admired nation we live in train students not headed for college for realistic careers and stop busting the budgets and burdening the futures of so many who do go on to university? And finally, did we learn anything from the crash of 2008? I mean, how on earth have we allowed our financial sector to accumulate even greater derivative positions than prior to the crash, and to concentrate its assets in even fewer institutions than before, and to take home a massive and unprecedented share of the economy's profits? It's completely crazy. In this part of today's show, we're going to be talking about those important questions. We're going to find out what has caused the problem to exist, and most importantly, what it is that we as Americans can do to overcome that and to make lives for all of us a lot better.
Jill, why don't you tell the class what you did this weekend?
Well, my dad and I went in search of some magical minnows and found a zillion of them in the stream from our lookout rock. Then my sister and I escaped from an evil slug king and went back to my super twig fort for safety. Then we told stories till it got dark, and the Big Dipper led us all the way home.
Whoa. Where were you, Jill?
We went to the forest. It's not that far away.
Ask your parents to take you and your friends to the forest this week. It's closer than you think. Check out discovertheforest.org. Brought to you by the U.S. Forest Service and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott. My guest for this part of today's show is James Stone, who's the author of Five Easy Theses, Common Sense Solutions to America's Great Economic Challenges. Jim, thanks for joining us.
Oh, glad to be here.
I'm sure you did this on purpose. You and I are of an age where we remember the old Jack Nicholson movie, Five Easy Pieces, which had to do with piano pieces, but still kind of foundational things. Tell us a little bit about why five instead of three or eight.
Sure. First of all, it's not a coincidence. Yes, I did like that movie. And because I did feel I had five subjects to talk about, it just seemed right. The word easy is a little facetious here, because what I've tried to do in Five Easy Theses is to lay out political issues that don't seem to get solved at all. So Congress doesn't find them easy. But I think the public should. I think that these have easy logical answers. They just have no simple political answer. And as for the number five, as opposed to some other, these are the five subjects I felt I'd had some experience in my various careers in dealing with. So, you know, I felt a little more comfortable talking about these five than any others.
Yeah. Well, you've had quite a background in insurance and at the CFTC, the Commodity Futures Trading Commission. So you certainly know whereof you speak. Let's start with Social Security. And this is something I think that it just makes such good sense. I just read something the other day about LeBron James. And somebody was using LeBron James as an example of, you know, I can't remember, is it $115,000 or something, that when you stop paying Social Security tax And you got somebody like LeBron James who's making $115 million. And if he paid whatever the 7.5% is on that extra money, if we all did, there would be a lot more in Social Security for our grandkids.
Sure. And I've never said that it was wrong to raise that limit and collect more from people with big incomes. But it's not a perfect solution. First of all, the very wealthy, you've picked an exception. The very wealthy are people who own companies, and they get their money in unrealized capital gains that just accumulate. It never shows up as income, so they wouldn't be taxed. You're basically taxing high earners and not the very wealthy if you raise that cap. But in addition, it's not going to be enough money. It could be enough money today if you got rid of the cap entirely. But I think that we're going to make a lot of progress as a society scientifically in the fight against cancer and heart disease very soon. People now live to be about 80 on average. If we beat cancer and heart disease or even come close to that, people will live well into their 90s. And raising the cap just won't be close to enough to pay for it.
So what do we do?
So nobody wants to do this, but we don't really have any choice. We have to raise the age at which you become eligible for Social Security payments. As you know, people say 70 is the new 60, or it's that kind of change that's occurring in our society where people are working longer, healthy longer, and so we just have to say you retire later, you work longer, and I think that's an inevitable thing to do.
Now, do you
politically
think that,
hard to face.
Do you think there should also be perhaps a limit, an income limitation on whether you can collect Social Security at all?
I have mixed feelings about that. I don't think that anyone who's wealthy above some reasonable limit needs it, but part of the political support from Social Security, and a lot of people who are fans of Social Security will tell me this, is from the fact that it's in part an insurance program and not just a government tax and spend program. So you take away the insurance aspect if some people are ineligible to collect anything, even though they've put in money all their lives, and that loses it some support. So on fairness grounds, I'd be with you. On political grounds, I'm not sure.
Now, why do you think it is, though, that it's such a holy cow? People just constantly are talking about the Social Security lockbox, and they're never going to change it. Are they pandering to everybody in Florida, or why is that there is such reluctance to even talk about making any changes at all?
This has been an issue in which politicians have not looked good. It is very easy to demagogue it and talk about picking on old people. As soon as anyone raises any issue about the money, even in the most sensible, rational way. And so it's been demagogued whenever that comes up, and politicians are therefore afraid to touch it. It's sometimes referred to as the third rail of politics. But, most of the things in my Five Easy Thesis book are things that politicians are afraid to touch. That's kind of the point of the book.
Yeah.
The public can make these things happen if the politicians won't, and that's probably the only way they'll get done.
And how are we going to do that as the public without any particular power?
Yeah, well, democracy is always frustrating in that regard. Yeah. Everybody thinks, I only have my one vote and it doesn't change anything. But the truth is that our government is always going to be run and influenced by vested interests, except when the public as a mass rises up and overrules. And the public can do that, and it does throughout history. So it takes a process of education and people agitating for change, understanding the need for change, and eventually you do get a change in mindset and culture, and it does drive the politicians to do what the public demands. Mm.
Well, there is one topic out of the five that people are actually spending a lot more time talking about now than I remember in any other recent election cycle. Bernie Sanders has been at the forefront of this thing, talking about income inequality and the gap between the super rich and everybody else, but particularly the people at the bottom. That's something that it seems now is an okay conversation to have. Are we getting all the facts, though?
Well, I think that that actually all of the candidates that are left, three of them, have mentioned it as an issue now. And that's a good thing. When I started writing the book, I didn't know that that would happen. I'm glad to see that in the forefront. And I think it is, in many ways, the most intractable of the issues. The country is drifting very rapidly in what I consider to be a terrible direction, where people talk this year about angry voters. Well, the median income in the United States has not increased since 1974. There's been a huge amount of wealth generated, and it's all gone to the top. We do need to do something about that, and it's difficult.
But, you know, where the thing falls apart, though, I think, is when you start looking at your own checkbook and you say, wait a minute, hold on, I've worked really hard, and I don't want somebody taking my money and giving it to somebody else who hasn't worked hard.
Well, as I said, the median income hasn't increased at all. So for most people, they're not going to find that is a problem if you start to change wealth distribution. You're really looking mainly at people who are extremely wealthy. And we don't really tax them now because their wealth comes in the form of unrealized gains. That is, the stock in businesses that they own keeps rising. Their assets keep getting worth more and more. And if we don't tax it along the way, and then we don't tax it at death because that's become unpopular, then we never get it. And we end up with exactly what our founding fathers didn't want when they set up the country, which is an aristocracy.
But if you're talking about
aristocracy,
if you're talking about taxes, though, it sounds like you're saying that the solution is to have more government programs as opposed to, you know, the teach a man to fish kind of a thing, you know, giving people the capacity to earn more as opposed to get a bigger handout.
I would loathe to think that the kind of teaching program education you're talking about would change wealth distribution in this country for the better. But I don't think that's likely. Those are wonderful programs, and I'm for them. They will change income distribution somewhat, and that's good. But to change wealth distribution is much, much harder. Wealth distribution is even more unequal by a lot than income distribution, and it is getting worse much more rapidly. So I wouldn't count on any kind of educational program to fix that. It can only be fixed with taxes, as unpopular as they are. You've got to go and say, this is where there are billions and billions or trillions of dollars, and if we don't tax it, we end up with an aristocracy where success is no longer determined by merit but by bloodlines, and that's the worst thing we could do in this country.
Talking with James Stone, who's the author of Five Easy Theses, Common Sense Solution to America's Greatest Economic Challenges. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we will keep talking to Jim.
Dear Mom and Dad, well, the Army has finally seen fit to give me some time off, so I'm writing to tell you that I'm doing fine over here. And Mom, since you asked, if anyone wants to help, just tell them to contact the USO. You can't believe how much they do for us. With love, your son Michael.
The USO depends on the generosity of the American people. To find out how you can help, visit us at USO.org. The USO, until everyone comes home.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott. If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Jim Stone, who's the author of Five Easy Theses, Common Sense Solutions to America's Greatest Economic Challenges. And this is theses, the plural of thesis, just so you don't think I'm saying something that's different. Let's keep moving, since there's only five. I want to get to all three of these.
Sure.
The education system here, I mean, that's something that also that's come up in elections, but it's also probably comes up in pretty much every person's house is, you know, does everybody need to go to college? And can we find something to do productive with people who don't go to college? And is there anything wrong with not going to college? Talk about your thesis. Sure. Well, talk about, I guess, before you talk about the thesis, what's wrong and what do you want to do to fix it?
Yeah. Well, first let me address what you just said, because realistically, not everybody is going to go to college and get a four-year degree. In fact, 70% of people in this country are not. And we have to accept that that is the reality. It's not going to change rapidly, if at all. And so with that fact in mind, here's what I think is wrong. Our high school system has moved towards one-size-fits-all. That's a big mistake, because it isn't one-size-fits-all. Some are brilliant and will go on to be scientists, and some are going to have occupations that don't require the same kind of education. And we're not providing the kind of vocational and occupational training that the 70% of the population who are not going to get college degrees need. So our high school system is not serving more than two-thirds of the people properly. And our college system, which is actually quite good by international standards, is just too expensive. And so while the system provides a good education for those 30% that are lucky enough that they're going to get a BA, the truth is, by the time they're done, that they're saddled with tremendous amounts of debt. So it's not really serving either group very well. So who does it serve? Well, if you're brilliant and rich, it serves you just great.
Well, even if you're just not even brilliant and rich, you'll be fine. You'll be able to get yourself in someplace. I'm just trying to figure out what you do about all this, because it's easy to say, well, let's make education free. Yeah. But, you know, unless we go back to the previous topic and increase taxes so that we can make education free. But then if we're putting all those dollars into the education, then we're not going to be able to have it for the social programs for the people who need to eat as opposed to get an education. It's a complicated thing here.
For exactly that reason, that wouldn't be my solution. I imagine a two-part solution. One is to use the kinds of best practices that we know work in the K through 12 system by observing schools that have been creative and done things better, but we don't really use these best practices the way we ought to. That's at the here and now level. What I'd really like to see, though, is universal national service after high school, where people spend a year or two, and if you're not going on to college, you learn a skill, you get your vocational and occupational training then. And if you are going on to college, because you've done this work for the country, you earn credits to help pay for your education when you do go to college. So that's what I'd really like to see. In the meanwhile, I think schools should adopt these, what I consider to be, fairly well-proven best practices.
Such as?
Yeah, I've listed them in the book, but they include, we should have universal schooling before first grade, kindergarten, or even pre-K. We should have longer hours in the schools. They're getting too short. We should have schools where kids get personal attention from teachers. If they get a lot of it at home, it's not all that necessary. But if they don't, it's absolutely necessary that somebody help them understand that doing well in school is a good thing. There's a lot of data-driven administration that's used in the best schools that isn't used in some of the others, and it could be. We don't provide much leadership training for high school principals and elementary school principals. We could. And if we did that, then we should give them hiring flexibility as well. I'd like to see, frankly, some increased discipline and respect for education in the schools that I think has gone south a little. And then finally, I would say that modern technology is providing all kinds of tools that can be used in the classroom that are really not being used yet, but will make education, I think, much more effective.
You're talking about a lot of the interactive apps and things like that?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, we can make learning fun with some of those things. And we can get away from one size fits all. I mean, I imagine taking a test on your computer, and based on how you answer the questions, it sends you to one set of readings if you did this well, and another set of readings if you did that well.
Yeah.
All of that will help, and that's coming.
And well, it's all certainly available right now if somebody wanted to do it. I mean, that's you're not talking about anything that's terribly complicated to do for a savvy tech person.
Well, that's right. Yeah. But in order to do it, we have to commit resources in the right way to education.
Right. Nobody's going to do it for free. Yeah. All right. So let's talk about, well, I want to say one of the big ones, but they're all big here.
They're all pretty big. Yeah.
Healthcare is something, you know, everybody is going to have some sort of probably an unpleasant experience with the healthcare system, whether that's a deductible that they can't meet or not being able to make the premiums or something, or somebody's being denied a certain kind of coverage because it just isn't covered on their policy. It's a mess, really. And, you know, talking about getting rid of Obamacare, whatever it is, I mean, the thing that frustrates me is there's a lack of solutions that are being proposed and just a bunch of criticisms of things.
Well, healthcare in the United States is pretty good by international standards, but it's only pretty good. We spend 18% of GNP on healthcare. Nobody else spends more than about 10%. That difference, if measured in dollars, is over $1 trillion a year. And what do we get for it? Well, we don't seem to have better life expectancy. We don't have better infant mortality. We don't have healthier lifespan. We don't have less obesity. We don't have better morbidity. We're spending $1 trillion a year for which we're getting almost nothing. And $1 trillion is a pretty big number when you were talking about what we could use money for if it were available. This is where the money is. This is where the most is wasted.
And what's it being wasted on?
Point to the places.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm mostly curious about. I mean, is it going to administrators of the insurance companies, or you know, because obviously you want to have if you're going to have a high class healthcare system, you're going to need to have very expensive procedures, probably. So there's that, and there's pharmaceutical development that is going to make medication expensive sometime. But that's probably not going to be your $1 trillion.
Well, some of those things do contribute, but as you mentioned, marketing and administration is much more expensive in the United States than anywhere else, but by a lot. So there's a lot of money there to save. But pharmaceuticals are another place, because we're about the only country whose policies seem to be designed to raise the prices of prescription drugs rather than to lower them. We don't bargain with pharmaceutical companies. We have extremely pro-business patent laws. So we push up pharmaceutical prices and pay much more for drugs than anybody else. And then there's diagnostic testing. We do a great deal more of that than anybody else, a lot of it driven by defensive medicine and the tort system. And then the hardest of all of them, which is end-of-life care. But end-of-life care, while there are very difficult issues that I don't have solutions to in end-of-life care, I've got one, and that is we can ask people when they're healthy how much end-of-life care they want and then obey them. And we don't do that now. So people get a lot more end-of-life care in a lot of cases than they would want.
And
it's very, very expensive.
Yeah, and so much of that is happening. I can't remember the statistics that I read, but it was a very high percentage just happening all the last month or last 2 months. And
yeah.
I don't know. I think there would
That's
be a tremendous, tremendous sense of guilt if you didn't do everything you could as the relative or primary caretaker of somebody who's towards end of life.
Except that we need to obey people's own wishes about that.
Yeah.
If somebody says, once my quality of life is gone and I don't want to be kept on a respirator, or when I'm for sure dying, I want to die at home with my loved ones and family and not in an intensive care unit, we should obey them. And we would save just a huge amount of money by doing that.
James Stone, the author of 5 Easy Theses, Common Sense Solution to America's Greatest Economic Challenges. We only got through 4. There's one more. You're going to have to get the book to read it. Jim, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, well, I'm very glad to have been with you. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Positive Parenting. You can get more information on today's show and what we're working on in the weeks ahead at MrDad.com. While you're there, visit the MrDad.com gift shop with everything you need to help you become the dad or mom you want to be. Positive Parenting is a production of the MrDad.com radio network. Now, go be a great parent.